train till they call the cops. Call us the California Honey Drops. A little young, a little old, with a little bit of soul. Here's a little something you ain't heard before. We played on the street, we made a little coin, built a time machine and picked up Mr. Boynes. Everybody's having fun, and we only just begun. We gonna party till the morning comes. We gonna party till the morning comes.
Today's episode of Cooking Issues has been brought to you by Wilma Jean Restaurant, serving delicious fried chicken and other Southern comfort food classics, plus great burgers, located at 345 Smith Street. For more information, visit WilmaJean345.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, today coming to you live on Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45. A little bit later, as late as we can push it. You see, we get kicked out of here because, you know, we got people coming in, they got to get ready for their program, all this other stuff. So we get Heidi Hoed out, and, you know, sometime around 12:50, somewhere in that general region. Call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Joined, as usual, with Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I haven't seen you in a while because I was in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, nice. How you been?
Fine.
Oh, that was not the... You didn't see it. You know how, like, when someone asks you something and you're about to say something and your lips close and your mouth inflates like you're about to say something and then you're like...
Like shake, she's about to say not fine?
Yeah, shake it off and
or
then say fine.
Another F word, yeah.
Like... Yeah, fine. That's what, yeah, just for you, if you can get that visual image. And Jack Inslee in the booth. How you doing?
I'm great. That was awesome.
Yeah.
How did you like the hams?
Oh, the hams are delicious. Yeah, we did a ham
tasting. Last
time
I saw you, yeah. Why don't you tell everybody?
It was Wednesday. It was the Wednesday. So, you know, last week we were at Harvard, which is why we didn't do the show, unfortunately. We wanted to, but the problem is it's scheduled for right before, and so I couldn't. Anyways. Sam Edwards, who... as well as Edwards and Sons, is a sometime sponsor of our program and of the radio show, radio network in general, is a well-known sponsor, set up along with Patrick Martins, a ham tasting, which is actually like a very expanded new version of, you know, something that I think he's done a couple of times, and I did once in 2004, showcasing American country hams tasted side by side with their European counterparts. Had a lot of interesting people there. How many did we taste, Jack? Like 14 or something?
I think it was like 20.
20? So it was a lot. It was a lot of ham.
I made it to about 14 or 15.
I ate fistfuls of ham more than other people did because that's just how I roll. But the next day, I was like. That's my I need water noise.
Yeah, that night is that was like that.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh my god. Oh my geez. And some interesting Virginia apple cider from that was good. But anyway, but so is there a write up of this whole thing somewhere on the Heritage Radio
That's
archives?
A good question. I'll post it on Twitter. Some information. I don't know.
Yeah, but go check it out just because like I could sit here and go, you know, blow by blow, but you know, I think Stas, you were there, what do you think?
I thought it was good. I didn't sit.
A woman of many words.
Yeah.
It was good.
Yeah.
Anyways, a lot of interesting hams, including one of the interesting developments over the past 8, 9, 10 years is American ham producers using controlling the feed of the animals. So we had some peanut-fed American hogs and some other interesting stuff. So it's a very interesting tasting.
I have Michael Nacken on the line, too, as well.
Oh, yeah? All right. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Dave. Can you hear me?
Yeah, what's going on?
Awesome, man. Hey, I called to give you a hard time.
Okay.
Let me guess.
Okay, so you know the person who had the dust mite allergy, and you were talking to him about how when you start to feel a reaction coming on, a lot of times you'll just take some Benadryl and see what happens?
At least for me, that's true. Yeah, yeah.
So I have some experience with this, too much, in fact, because my wife has an anaphylactic reaction to peanuts and tree nuts, and I've been to the ER with her probably 15 times in the past 10 years because restaurants are really shitty about knowing what they have nuts in, unfortunately.
Right.
But she's been this, sort of the same as you. Like, she's been having these reactions since she was a little kid, and she's gotten pretty casual about them and would often just take some Benadryl and kind of wait to see what happens, and, you know, maybe we'll go in, maybe we won't. And then just last year, there was a 13-year-old girl at a camp, I think it was in New Jersey or something like that, who did exactly that. She'd been having reactions her whole life. She kind of knew how strong they were or weren't. Ate a Rice Krispie bar that turned out to have peanuts in it, took some Benadryl, thought she was fine, went to bed, and never woke up.
Oh, my God.
So it really is as tempting as it is to become casual about it. What can actually, like, one reaction can just get out of control, and you don't even know, and it's not even necessarily dose-specific or whatever. So you really should just always use that EpiPen and go in. Sucks.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, that sucks. Well, I mean, I guess that's true, and my reactions could get worse, and I guess I wouldn't know it either. I mean, I've never had, luckily for me, it's simply that my throat closes up. It's not that I go into full body shutdown, you know, or, but yeah, no, that's excellent advice and very sobering. Any good news to give me, Michael?
Good news, we're having all kinds of fun back here in Seattle.
Yeah?
Come see us.
Oh, next time, I need some reason. Maybe the book tour will send me out that way. Who knows?
That's right, yeah. I ordered my book, and also Lorraine, the social media person here at Chef Steps, just told me she ordered a book for our in-house library. So we are excited to see the cocktail book, man.
Oh, nice. Hey, speaking of in-house library, did you hear that Food Arts closed? Sad. Said, you know, Food Arts Magazine, which was kind of like, you know, it's actually my first.
Yeah.
What made me think of it was in-house library this morning when I heard they closed down. Like, they had a huge, because they were sent every advanced cookbook, you know, advanced copies of cookbooks for reviews for the past,
right.
For the past like 30 years. And I used to go into their conference room was the library where all their stuff was. And this morning I'd been thinking about how kind of sad it was because Michael Batterbury, you know, and Ariane, the two founders of it, they got me my first job in food, and they've been very helpful for, you know, millions of people, not millions, but many people, like Patrick, for instance. And I was just thinking this morning when I got up, I was like, I wonder what's happening to all those books. I hope they're donating them to some, you know, library or culinary school or something like that, because it's an amazing collection they had. Yeah,
maybe you better get over there. You could put a, you know, library wall of Booker and Dax.
Well, I would feel a little bit mercenary, being like, "Oh, hey, and your books." You know what I mean? That's something that Nastasia would accuse me of doing, right? She, like, Nastasia likes to think of me as this kind of just evil person, so she would. That's how she would hope that I would do. She, like, thinks of me that way, right, Stas?
Yes.
Well, you distract them, and Nastasia can make off with the books on the dollar.
Wow! Now Michael's calling you out, Stas. It's like the sneak thief. Yeah. That's kind of right, though. I guess the more you know her, the more she's a sneak thief. Well, anyway, thanks for that word of caution, because I definitely don't want to be responsible for someone not going into the hospital when they should. And it is true that these things, your severity can change at any time, correct?
Yeah, that seems to be the truth. Sad but true.
Yeah, someday the doctors will figure this out and will kick the whole dang thing.
You know, they're doing a lot of really interesting work on it where they sensitize you with absolutely microdoses over a long period of time, and they can at least get you to the point where you don't die.
Yeah, I mean, McGee's keeps on saying he's going to work on that with, because he's shellfish allergies, and he keeps on saying he's going to work on it. I mean, mine are so, you know, specific and mild that I don't think it's worth, you know, messing with. But if I had something as pervasive and dangerous as a nut allergy, maybe I'd give it a shot. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I suppose you don't really run into cherries randomly being in things, huh?
Yeah, no, not so much. I mean, at certain times a year I do, and then if they're cooked, it's fine, unlike, you know, peanuts, which don't appear to be destroyed by the processing.
No, not at all.
Yeah, like I've had cooked cherries and not died, you know, so that's good. And again, like I say, for me, it's like, you know, it's fairly mild. It's just like the throat closing, which is only not mild because you can't breathe anymore and you need the oxygen. But it's not the – you know what I'm saying? It's like you need the oxygen, but other than that, I'm fine.
Yeah, to me the throat closing doesn't sound mild. I'd be upset if my throat was closed, but I hear you that you feel comfortable, so that's good.
Yeah, well, people think it's hilarious because I have like a sweet, sweet Donald Duck voice when it happens. I sound just like Donald Duck until just before it starts to fully close up. So it's an amusing way to go for other people.
Yeah, well, let's keep you around for a few more years if possible.
All right, thanks, brother. Thanks for calling in.
All right, bye. Take care.
Thanks. Hey, Jack, do you have a reverb button over there?
Yes.
Sweet. Keep it on for a second. We're doing a new session called Cooking Issues Shoutouts. Yes, that's it. That's all I needed. We have some shoutouts that we have to do. We got to use that more often. We got to do like a
that's cool.
Can we announce like a monster truck rally?
Yeah, you just give me the heads up.
And we'll do the Sunday.
Yeah.
For all of those. Do they have those, Stas? Do they have Sunday in California?
I don't remember. I mean, it's been too long.
You would remember.
I would remember, maybe.
Sunday. We got to do it. Sunday. No, you don't remember that?
No.
Jack, you remember that, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, that's when monster truck rallies always are. They're on Sundays.
I've heard them. I don't think that they were in California.
You know, there's two kinds of monster truck rallies. Well, there's probably a billion now, but when I was a kid, there's two kinds. I went to the wrong kind. Like, there's the one with the monster trucks that drive over things and crush things, and that's what everyone wants to see, right? And then there's ones where they just pull crap, and that's the one I went to.
Yeah, and then there's also the demolition derbies where a bunch of beat-up, crappy cars just, like, crash into each other.
Do you know, I've never seen one, and it's kind of like a dream.
Really?
I would love to see one.
I've been to multiple as a kid. They're the best.
I would love to see a demolition derby. I mean, they still do the same thing that I used to know about. They fill the doors with concrete and whatnot.
Yeah.
So sweet. Anyway, okay. So our shout outs. Our good buddy Daniel Rosenberg, who I don't know his exact title over there.
I don't know.
He's at the Harvard, and there's a building over there called the Science Center, which is kind of cool because they have all the sciences are in there, and they have a demonstration services thing. And Daniel's the guy there, you know, and so we go there all the time, and he has control over all the sweet, sweet, sweet demos that all of the science classes have at Harvard. There's like one or two, like, you know, moron programs at Harvard that don't use the science building, and I'm sure they feel incredibly weak and stupid because they don't have Daniel doing their sweet, sweet demos, because he can set up anything. You're like, hey, I want to throw some sodium into some water and, like, you know, have it explode. He's like, got you covered. Remember that when he did that for us? It was so sweet, so awesome. He was a little mad at us last year when we didn't give him the information for the demo we were going to do, and then set off the fire alarm and cleared out the building. But he's over it now. He's not angry with us anymore about that, right, Stas?
Not angry with you anymore.
Anyway, so saw him last week at the Harvard, and he wanted to give us a shout out because he's working with the Ig Nobel. You know, familiar with the Ig Nobel Prizes?
Mm-mm.
It's like Nobel, but
yeah,
Ig Nobel.
No, like...
Yeah, yeah. So the Ig Nobel Prize ceremony. He's involved with it this year, and it's kind of cool. Like they give out awards to kind of non-consequential but cool science kind of things, So what you want to do is go see, and this year it's food theme. He has some food theme stuff. So he's doing some, like, crazy dumb s'more stuff on the on this promo video, which you should watch. And you should watch the live webcast that they're going to have, because this I don't know the day. Jack, could you look up
September
the
date? September
18th. All right. It's September 18th. There's a live webcast. It is the 24th First International Ig Nobel Prize ceremony. Every year it's always the first, like it's the 27th. Anyway, go look at it on improbable.com. Check out his 30-second promo for the Ig Nobel Prize ceremony and check it out. One of the things they have that you might find interesting, they have these things called 24/7 lectures where they get very eminent scientists to come in, and the thing is they have to explain in technical terms, give a full technical explanation of their field in 24 seconds.
Ooh.
Yeah, and then a 7-word summary of what they do that is understandable by any layperson, completely understandable by any layperson. So what this actually boils down to is people start trying to explain what's going on, and in 27 seconds they get to blow a very loud, like, coach whistle in the ear of extremely eminent scientists. And then, but sometimes they come up with, like, really amazing definitions. Like, I forget what her name was, but some well-known biologist came up with, like, the most awesome definition of biology ever, and it goes like this: if it gets infected, it's biology. There it is. Biology. 7 words. Sweet. Anyways, second shout out. Greg Mueller. I guess it's Mueller, right? Because it's M-U, like Mueller, like with an umlaut. But I don't know if once you're in America, whether they just go with Mueller. What do you think? Mueller. Anyway, wrote in. How about a shout out? We are doing an event in Lyon in January with Chef George Castaneda, and it's called the Catering Cup, International Catering Cup, another ICC, another freaking ICC, International Culinary Center, mm-hmm. International Chef Conference, International Culinary Cup, Catering Cup. Anyways, it's kind of cool. It's a competition, and this is the first year. It's every 2 years, I think, and this is the first year that the Americans are competing. In fact, so new that the weasels up at internationalcateringcup.com didn't put the American team on their page yet, but we're there, America. We're going. So you should check it out and support it. Cateringcup.com/English. And the shtick is this. Each team must prepare the same dishes. This year it's 100% duck pate en croûte, an exotic fruit chutney, a whole stuffed a whole trout stuffed with cod and scallops with a cold emulsion sauce, an item made from three types of pork. That's so much less specific than the other ones.
Yeah.
Hey, I want a trout stuffed with cod and scallops, and then, you know, three kinds of pork. Like, what is that? It's nuts. French. And a dessert using dark chocolate tartlets, Victoria pineapple. What is a Victoria pineapple?
Don't know.
Coconut and lime. So check out cateringcup.com/English. And if you happen to be, it's not slash English, slash EN. And if you happen to be American, vote for us. And you can't really vote. It's like one of those things where they test you on first of all, taste, and second of all, presentation. I don't know which one's first. Hopefully it's taste. And then, like, you know, cleanliness and blah, 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 blah. I don't know whether they judge you on your spiel or not. That's the way cocktail competitions are. They just judge you on spiels. Spiels. Speaking of cocktails, just got back from Chicago. Like I said, was doing Mod Mex with Rick Bayless, who set up this thing called Mod Mex, which is, I guess, modern Mexican, where they get some Mexicans, some people, Americans doing Mexican stuff, and then just some knuckleheads like me going over there and working with Mexican ingredients and kind of talking about how these ingredients and or techniques have place in modern, modern kitchens. Interesting. Not modern necessarily meaning kind of like what we do, but just kind of like contemporary. Had some really interesting stuff over there. Was at Frontera in Topolobampo and had delicious banana leaf ice cream. It's good. It's like almost like it was delicious. Anyway, I don't know. Oh, and I also got to go to Aviary, but I don't really have time to talk about going to Aviary. Had a lot of cocktails. I'm not able to finish them all because there's just so many cocktails. And it's a sign, I think, of how adult I've become that I did not even attempt to finish all the cocktails.
Well, that's Damon Bolte's like number one piece of advice when you go to a cocktail event. He said never, ever finish a cocktail.
Even Damon Bolte says that?
Damon Bolte says that. So if he says it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, those of you who don't personally know Damon Bolte, let me just say, the man knows how to squirrel away some liquor inside himself. So, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And he's one of those freaking, like, culinary twins here in, what does his brother do, Stas?
Rolling Stone? Or Spin Magazine?
Writer?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, so he's at least only one half of the twins are in culinary stuff here, but there's, like, so many culinary twins, and then when you see, like, the one and you don't know it's the other here, I can think of, like, four or five sets of twins here in the New York area. It freaks me out. I mean, whatever, it's not his fault. I mean, right? Anyway, okay. Kyle Payton wrote in, says, can I get more information on the bottle-style carbonation setup you have for home seltzer? I have an actual inline carbonator. Well, rooty tooty for me. But if you want to do bottle-style carbonation, which in the end is much more more economical than using a soda stream, right? I mean, it's a little more of a pain in the butt, but it's much more economical. What you need is a CO2 tank. Now, it depends on how your counters are. Some people can fit a full 20-pound CO2 tank under their counter. If you can't, right, like I can't because mine goes underneath where my sink is, and so it just doesn't clear. But most of you can if you have a full cabinet depth that you can fit it in. Remember to strap it down. You don't want to have it fall over. Don't keep a lot of CO2 tanks because if one breaks, you don't want it to asphyxiate you by opening the stuff up, but yada, 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 yada. Anyways, you can get a 20-pounder. You can get a 5-pounder, which is a lot smaller, but there's a little-known and little-used 10-pound unit. So what I recommend is going to Mark Powers, who they're in Guntersville, Alabama, and they can sell you – they have the best price on like the regulators, the hoses, and the fittings. So all you need is – and they'll sell you an empty tank, and you get it refilled at a welding supply shop in your area. And you can usually just drive – if you live in the suburbs, you can drive your in the trunk, put your – in the trunk, drive in, and swap them out. And it's relatively inexpensive. You know, everything depends on where you live, but a 20-pound CO2 tank can do like 400 gallons of seltzer and cost less than $20, okay, to swap out. So you get your empty tank. You own a high-pressure regulator, because the lower-pressure ones that are made for beer don't go quite high enough, especially if you're going to use things like cocktails. You need to also buy – you don't need it, but I would highly recommend buying what's called a regulator cage, and it's a metal thing that goes around your regulator so that the gauges don't get smashed. You can buy very expensive expensive gauges that kind of don't get smashed, but in general they're hundreds of dollars, whereas the regulator I buy is more like $30. It's a tap right, and it's very cheap because it's made to, you know, be used by every person who has like a brew, you know, a beer setup in their restaurant. So they sell 8 bajillion of them, and they're consequently fairly cheap. They're not quite as accurate maybe, but you probably don't care. What you do care is that they're fairly fragile. So I would get those cages that you just bolt onto the back. I would also buy an extra plastic washer for the high-pressure CO2 washer and the tank washer. And the reason is there's usually a little rubber thingamajiggy on the regulator that seals with the high pressure on the CO2 tank, but sometimes this can degrade. And if you have one of the plastic white things zip-tied to your regulator at all times, then no matter what happens, you are able to seal your tank properly and you're good. So get one of those and then use a bunch of flex hose. I use 1/4 beverage hose, which is it's like braided reinforced polyethylene hosing. That stuff never breaks. The stuff that people will sell that's more flexible, they consider better for carbonating because it's not as stiff. I've seen break a bunch of times. The unreinforced stuff, like the red specifically tubing that people sell, so I'd stay away from that. And there's a hose barb fitting that goes on, and there's a little flare. It's a flare fitting, a flare CO2 washer, and then I would take it directly to a barbed gas fitting, which is the gray fitting from a beverage, from a ball lock connector, the old stuff. And you can get this all from Mark Power. And you want some clamps that clamp down on it. You can use a little hand hose clamps that screw down, but I hate them. I hate them. I don't use them. I use what we're called Oedeker clamps, which are little things that crimp down and have ears, and they never come off, and they don't cut my hands, and I don't hate them like I hate the other ones. But if you're only making one rig, just use the ones that I hate that have a little screw, but man, I hate them. And after that, that's everything you need except for the carbonator cap, which you can get on Amazon.com. It's called Liquid Bread is the corporation that makes it, the carbonator cap, and some soda bottles, which you can save. Make sure that the liquid is extremely cold. You can even smash a couple small chunks of ice into the bottle when you're carbonating, because carbonating raises the temperature of the stuff slightly. Make sure it's ice cold. You can even have some ice in the bottle. Fill it 2/3 to with water 3/4 of the way through. Fill, squeeze all the air out, screw the carbonator cap on, carbonate it at like 35, depending on 40 PSI. Don't turn it upside down because there's no check valve in this system. You don't want water rolling in. Shake it, vent it once, shake it again, throw it in your fridge, and seltzer for days! What do you think?
Yep.
Yeah? Okay.
How about a quick break?
Yeah.
Ooh, okay, quick break. Coming back with cooking issues.
Today's episode of Cooking Issues is brought to you by the restaurant Wilma Jean, serving delicious fried chicken and other Southern food comfort classics. Great burgers, too. They're located at 345 Smith Street. And these are the people behind Seersucker and Nightingale 9. So again, that's Wilma Jean, WilmaJean345.com. One more announcement. We've got a great event. The Silver Snail, 25 years of slow food, will be hosted by Slow Food USA, Heritage Radio Network, and Roberta's Pizza. It's been 25 years since Carlo Petrini and a group of activists launched a peaceful revolution to defend regional traditions, good food, gastronomic pleasure, and a slow pace of life. The slow food movement has since evolved into a comprehensive approach to food that recognizes the strong connections between plate, planet, people, politics, and culture. Today, this movement involves thousands of projects and millions of people in more than 160 countries worldwide. Join us for a dialogue between Slow Food's founder, Carlo Petrini, and locavore activist Alice Waters as they reflect on the evolution of the food movement and all things slow. That's Friday, October 3rd, from 11:30 to 2:30 p.m. at Roberta's.
You know what's weak, Jack? You had all those peas, and then you had to throw in culture?
I know.
You had all those freaking peas. Give me the peas again.
Plate, planet, people, politics, and culture.
Yeah, what the hell? Couldn't you think there's no word for culture to start with a P? I mean, you should either change some of the other ones so you don't have all the peas. And then you're like, oh, sweet, this dude's only using peas. You know what I mean? And then it's like, I mean, I would even just be like, and Pulcher.
You could do Planet, People, Politics, and Petrini.
Oh, yeah, you got Petrini working with People, Planets, what is it? People, Planets, Plates, Politics, Pulcher. Right? I mean, just do it. See what people say. I mean, like, you need to see. It's like, you need the P. The C just is not working for you, bro. I don't know. Anyway, maybe I'm wrong. I could be wrong.
I've got a caller on the line.
All right, caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
All right.
I have a question about the Fearsall and changing my shipping address because I'm moving to a new address since I funded on the Kickstarter.
Okay, where are you in the U.S. or are you abroad?
In the U.S.
Okay. Amazon already has all of the addresses. We've shipped all the addresses like to Amazon. We might be able to still change it, though. Is that true?
Yeah, we can change it.
Yeah, but Amazon already has all the addresses and all of the Searsalls have been built. There might still be time if you email the cooking issues, email like...
No, just email Searsall at bookerindex.com. If it goes to your old address, does that mean you're never going to see it, or is this just more convenient?
If it goes to the old address in the next 2 weeks, we're okay. If it goes after that, then I'll never see it.
Email Searsall at bookerindex.com, and we'll push through. Email today, and we'll push through the change with Amazon. We'll send confirmation out, because we're going to send a confirmation email on shipping along with the address.
Amazon,
right? Amazon's going to send you an email based, but not everyone sent us their email. Make sure we have the email with it so that we can add the email to the not everyone gave us their, is that true, or does everyone have an email?
Everyone has
an email, so put it there and it can go out, but hurry, because they already have all the shipping information.
Perfect. And that's Booker and dash A-N-D?
Yeah, A-N-D-D-A-X. Okay. And, you know, and again, like, I'm probably the – actually, Nastasia is probably the most frustrated.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm second most frustrated, and then maybe Drew, our partner's third most frustrated. But the Searsalls have all been built, and I can't – I mean, I'm supposed to not really – but they're literally just waiting for a reapproved instruction sheet. they're all built, and rest assured they are. In fact, I personally have seen 1,000 of them. There's 1,000 of them sitting in Booker and Dax's lab right now. Anyways, you don't want me to talk about it, Stas?
Well, I'm sure all the New Yorkers will come tear down the walls if they know they're sitting in the lab.
Well, don't do that. But anyway, so that's the story, and it's still possible. And then after everyone gets their fulfillment off of Kickstarter and ShopStarter, because obviously they come first, then the remainder from this shipment are going to go on Amazon. But we're not going to put up the pre-order before we ship, right?
We can't, because it's media only gets pre-order status. We're not media.
Okay, cool. But anyway, as soon as Amazon then starts shipping them out to the fulfillment stuff, then it'll go on Amazon.
Hey, Dave, is the book going to be out at Star Chefs, by the way?
When is Star Chefs this year?
What's that?
When is Star Chefs? Book comes out like first week of November, or like November 8th or November 9th. I think it's first week of November, like November 3rd. So if Star Chefs is after that, then the book will be out. But I don't know.
Oh, it's like the week before. It's like the last week of October.
Oh, busted.
Come on.
I don't know. I'll see. They will exist in the country, but I don't know whether or not they're allowed to do. Maybe they are. I'll talk to the publishers. If their publishers are allowed to do it, you know.
Yeah, because last year, Alex Benacki had their book out a week early.
Really? Well, I know that that might not have been with Norton. I know currently they're doing some work with Norton, which is my publisher, but I don't know whether that book was with Norton. But I'll talk to them, because that would be fun, right? Be fun.
I'll pick one up from the bar for me.
Yeah. All right. So we'll see. I'll see. I'll look into it. I'll definitely look into it.
Okay. Cool.
All right. Thanks a lot. Okay. Now, had a question in from Andrea. Hi there. I'm from Germany and listen to your show regularly. I have a question regarding baking without eggs. I am not a vegan, but I don't tolerate eggs, and all my attempts at baking cakes have been awful. Bundt and sponge cakes turn out extremely moist and heavy and not light and fluffy at all. This might be okay in a fudgy brownie-like cake, but I am looking for a sponge-slash-siphon cake that is usually just made with eggs, flour, sugar, and baking powder, and all that can be used for layering cakes with, whipping cream or Swiss rolls, kind of, or angel food cake, but with the yolks also being used. I've tried various egg replacers, but they don't work well either. Do you have any idea and a good recipe for that? Thanks for your help, Andrea. Okay, well, I mean, there's a number of things that eggs do, right? So the yolks provide – so if you're looking for like the tenderness like provision that you get out of things like yolks, right, then you can add – I guess you can just supplement the fat for the fat that's in the egg yolks, and you could probably add some emulsifiers like soy lecithin and something like this and probably get some of those effects. The other thing that the eggs have in them is protein, which provides structure for things like angel food cakes and sponge cakes as they're setting. So it aerates, right, because it can hold air, and then it sits there holding its structure until it's baked, at which point you form an actual interlocked cooked starch and protein network that holds the structure of the cake, you know, until you eat it, right? So the question is, how do you get around this? So some people try to make – if you look on the internet, which I'm not going to endorse any of these recipes because I've never made one. But if you look on the internet, some people used sweetened condensed milk in their eggless sponge cake stuff, presumably because the super thick structure of that allows the batter to hold its leavening and structure better as it's baking. So there's – what they're fundamentally doing, I would guess, is just increasing the viscosity of their of their batter. There might also be something because of the extra milk protein that's in it. I don't know. They're also jacking the sugar in it, but whatever. I guess they're reducing the sugar for the rest of the stuff. But that's presumably that's an increased viscosity effect. Maybe an effect from the protein in the milk. I don't know. If you're using an egg replacer, egg replacers, I think I have to look up specifically what kind of egg replacer you're using. There, by the way, is there are these folks in California who are working, and I think there's two separate companies, one of which already has one a product, I think, in Whole Foods, but they're working on direct egg replacers that satisfy kind of all of the culinary functions of eggs. I, again, have never used it, but I know Bill Gates is sponsoring one to the tune of millions and millions of dollars, so you have to wait for that guy to come out. But a lot of times what they're doing is, A, they're adding viscosity. Sometimes they're going to add protein, but probably not usually. And then they're going to add some sort of holding capacity for structure with something like xanthan, something that forms kind of a something that can form kind of a little bit of a gel, like a weak gel, but it's not going to be like too crazy with binding and messing with water. So you can add these kinds of things, like heavy xanthan makes it snotty for an egg replacer. But as you say, you haven't had a lot of luck with that. I have used in the past, Johnny Azzini and I years ago developed a sponge cake, eggless, actually like angel food cake almost, but it ended up being more like a sponge cake that used a product called Methocel, which is I think we were using, there's two different varieties we were testing, the SG, which is a super gelling series, and the A series. I don't know if we published it. I have to look online for like, and he might have published it on his own later, but it was Methocel-based kind of eggless angel food batter that we put through a siphon for aeration. And the main thing, shtick with that is that Methocel, when you heat it, it sets. It's like one of the few hydrocolloids that as you heat it, it forms a gel because it actually loses its ability to be loses its solubility and gels out as it's heated. So we would spray it out of an EC whipper, the batter. We'd spray it out into a pan. It would be pre-aerated. You throw it in an oven, and the heat of the oven, instead of expanding and popping the gel, which is what would normally happen in an oven, actually sets the gel. And so you would have these cakes that were set, and then as they cooked, the actual starch in there would be enough to hold this thing together. And then it would be fine. The problem with it is that Methocel responds poorly to milk. So you want to do a non-milk based recipe if you're gonna do that. Another thing you might want to do, and I've never tried it before, but you take whatever the water base of the eggs would be for whipping, right? And make a Gel-An fluid gel with it. The reason I use Gel-An is it doesn't break so much. So you then use a Gel-An fluid gel. You blend it so it's I would do it relatively thick. And then that structure, if you whip it or you have some way to whip it or aerate it beforehand or even with that, will hold its structure as it bakes and won't break. I haven't tried it again, but that's something you might want to try. Another thing is you could add extra thickening power to it in the form of other viscosity building agents. you know, I don't know exactly which one you want to use or what you have access to, but you know, that's in general what people are trying to do. Sorry, I don't have anything more specific. What do you think, Stas?
Good.
Yeah. All right. Boop. Philip Wolf wrote in. He saw us at the lecture last week at the Harvard. He wrote in, but he had actually interesting thing. One of the things we talked about was that McGee and I had, and Nils actually had done a course where we were cooking octopus after octopus after octopus. And we were trying to disprove the fact that a cork in an octopus makes a difference. But the fact of the matter is that if you use enough corks, we actually did repeatedly get a difference between cork and non-cork cooked octopus, and we didn't know why. And Philip had some interesting things where he'd said that he had read something and done some tests where change in temperature during cooking also affects the texture of octopus. So it's something to look at. But he had some questions. What's the best thing you've ever put into and gotten out of a RotoVap? I think the best thing I've ever done – did you ever have the cheese course, Stas?
No.
The best thing I've ever done isn't really a distillation – isn't really about like some fancy distillation. But the best thing was we took port, nice port, Ruby, and distilled it into a port brandy and then threw away the water and then distilled it down to a port syrup that had never been heated. And port syrup that's never been heated is ridiculous, ridiculous. And down to the like down to about 66 bricks, so like maple syrup style, all done, you know, kind of room temperature. We then did the same thing to a Madeira, Malmsey Madeira, and that syrup also stupid good. And then we did it to a Bum de Venise, you know, the dessert wine. Like amazing syrups and brandies all. And then took three small chilled the brandies, did not really, well, kind of room temp, a little cold, like white wine temp. Three brandies in small tasting cups, and then cheese courses. So we did with the port, we did Stilton, because duh. And then with the Stilton syrup, and I forget what I paired. We did a garnish as well, but I forget what we did with the garnish on that one. And then we did cheddar, like a really nice, like Montgomery was at the time. Montgomery was the best cheddar you can get. I don't know if it still is, but it was Montgomery's cheddar with the Malmsey Madeira, and then that and the syrup. And that one we did with flash pickled onions, like red onions, which make cheddar and onions. Duh. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Duh. And then we did the Bum de Venise. I wish I could remember all the garnishes. One of the garnishes we did, and this might have been with the port, was we did pressure cooked barley with coffee. I think it was with that one, maybe. Anyway, and then with the Bum de Venise, we did a really delicious pecorino Toscano and this syrup, but I forget what the garnish is. We'll have to look it up. But that's good. That was the best thing I ever done in RotoVap. And then, you know, other ones are just all kinds of random distillations that I like. Habanero, like doing habanero in the RotoVap was always good because it got rid of the spice and it was kind of a unique thing that you couldn't really do any other way. So I also like that. That was good. Two, have you ever used liquid nitrogen gel technique to put shards of gels into a foie gras torchon? If not, it's super cool, especially different herb gels, pretty cool with and chemo too. So here's what we're talking about. At the lecture, I was talking about how I think Sam Mason is like an ice cream genius, because it's true. And at Oddfellows, he kind of did this in Brooklyn. He did this technique where he took things like jellies and other things, froze them with liquid nitrogen, and then shattered them and folded them into his ice creams as they were being made. So instead of having swirls of crap, you would have like discrete pockets of crap inside the ice cream, because then as it tempers out, right, of course it turns to its normal jelly consistency, which is pretty cool. But apparently you can do it in other things as well. And when are you opening a Booker and Dax Cambridge outpost? Well, sadly, I don't know if we're ever gonna, are we ever gonna open another one, Stas?
It would be great if we could open one there.
I don't know. Yeah, but I like it actually in the Boston Cambridge area. You like it over there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? She's like, whatever, I don't care. I hate it everywhere. I'm an equal
not
opportunity
true.
Hater. But where do you not hate it?
You and I were supposed where to talk about it? Cambridge.
Yeah. Where do you not hate it? What's the name of a place you don't hate?
I like a lot of places.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
That wasn't an answer though.
Yeah. It was not an answer. Okay, and on a similar vein, Adrian Blackpool wrote in, "Hey Hammer, only writes to you, don't care about me. I didn't order the first generation of Searsol after the first run. Is there a second one planned already? Yeah, we're just going to keep making them as long as people keep buying them. The problem is, if you're in the UK, which it says you are, we're only going to sell them in the future on Amazon.us. So you're going to have to figure out some way to get them to like drop ship it overseas. Because, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But yes, the answer is yes. And could you speak to my second book? I don't even know what my second book is going to be about. But, you know, my editor, Maria Guarnaschelli, is anxious for us to figure out. When did I tell her I was going to figure that out?
First week of October.
You think that's going to happen?
No.
No, no, hell no. And is there anything else in the Booker and Dax pipeline? Answer, yes, but I don't want to talk about anything future until we get these Searsalls out the door. I have nothing publicly is on my mind until the Searsalls are out the door, right? Yeah. And finally, could you give any warning for UK dates so I can plan sick leave? Because I presume any dates you're going to be are in London. Because you're in Lancashire, UK. Yeah, I mean, I hope to come to London sometime for the book thing, because we can write it off, right? And the last question, how do I clean a Rotovap? I think I answered someone else on this, or I don't know, maybe you were writing in. Rotary evaporator, for those of you that don't know, is a piece of equipment it's a lab piece of equipment that does distillation under vacuum. So it allows you to do very gentle distillations. When you're cooking, it allows you to do distillations at very low temperature and without oxygen, which means that you can do very gentle, awesome things. However, they're expensive, and so people buy them used. And if you buy them used, you have the problem that really, really disgusting things have gone through them. So the short answer is I can never guarantee that your Rotovap will be safe. However, you need to clean, 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 and clean some more. I would boil it a couple of times, all the glassware. I would put it through an ultrasonic bath if you have it. I would clean it with as many solvents as you can get, starting with the least like food grade and working towards like pure ethanol if you can, and then water. I would then do some distillation runs through it, but the whole thing, all the grease, everything off of it, do some distillation runs with it to further get into every nook and cranny that you might somehow have missed. And just clean, 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 you know, like beyond the point when there's no smell anymore. You just have no idea what they put through it. You know what I'm saying, Stas?
True.
You have no idea, unless they tell you. Okay. We have Lucas wrote in. Lucas. Love Lucas. Hey, Dave, Nastasia, Jack, and Wyatt, although Wyatt hasn't come back, doesn't like us.
Wyatt's right here.
Oh, hey, Wyatt, you weren't here earlier.
Nope. He was late.
All right.
Like somebody else.
Well, there you go. Well, hey, oh, well, Lucas gave you a shout out. So howdy. Anyway, my all-time favorite food is bouillabaisse. Julia Child. I like bouillabaisse. You like it?
Mm-hmm.
What do you like better, bouillabaisse or you like San Francisco Chipino style?
I don't know.
Chipino's got the spicy sausage and stuff.
Oh.
And they serve it with the garlic bread next to it. I think I like Chipino better, although I like bouillabaisse. Anyway, my all-time favorite food is bouillabaisse. Julia Child advocates making stock by simmering less expensive parts of fish but never boiling it. This got me thinking of lobster stock, which when done in pressure cooker is unpalatable. Could these two things be related? And shall I make my fish stocks in a water bath well below 100°C? Okay. My answer to this. I think it's two separate things. The reason I don't think she wants you to boil the fish is because she doesn't want it to get too clouded up with weird bull crap from the bones and less expensive parts. So I think that's the thing against the boiling with the fish. But whereas lobster, if you do lobster stock, i.e. with the shells in a pressure cooker, you just get too much of that calcium shell note out. And I think anytime with lobster, I think a lot of people overcook their lobster stuff when they're using shells to get flavors out of, because there's a certain point at which you're not extracting flavor and just extracting that just shell note, and I hate that. So I think that's what that is. I don't know that I don't think I've ever tested temperatures on fish stocks before in a circular. I mean, obviously I've done a lot of tests with kombu, but not with fish. There's probably a difference, but I don't know that. Give it a try. Let me know. I don't know. But I think that those two things are not necessarily related. And what I do with the bouillabaisse anyway is I always buy usually whole fish, fillet them out, and then use all the bones and crap for the stock. And then I don't usually do any of that stuff traditionally. What I'll do is I'll take, for instance, I'll sweat the onions, then I'll do the wine, then I'll do all of my hard clams and whatnot, steam them open, get the juices out, pull the shells out, and then shuck and reserve, because I don't really like throwing the shells in. Do you like throwing – you don't like throwing the shells in, right? I reserve, and then I usually quickly cook the fillets and steam over that, and then remove and then throw the bones in, make the stock out of that, reserve, and then add all the meat together at the last second after I cook the veg out. But whatever. That's a little different. Each time I used to go to Booker and Dax with my girlfriend, I pointed at the Dewar in the front of the bar and tell her we need to buy one at home because I cannot keep one in my Manhattan apartment. No, tell her that we need to buy a home to have the liquid nitrogen. Good reason to have liquid nitrogen because I can't have one in my Manhattan apartment. Now I have a home and a couple of questions. How large a Dewar should I get? I imagine using it daily for the first 2 months and then probably once or twice a week afterwards. If I can get a large one, how much will I lose to evaporation per week? Well, first of all, I mean, I know you, so like you're going to look up the safety stuff because he's like a low temperature physicist, or was, before he's doing what he does now. And so I looked up on Taylor Wharton, which manufactures most of the Dewars, and a 180-liter Dewar loses about 1.25% a day, which amounts to about 2.25 liters. Then what they mean is 1.25% of total capacity, not of the current capacity. So, because otherwise it would be like radioactive decay and it would never go dry, which is not the way it works. 2.25 liters. And 160-liter Dewar loses 1.3% a day, which is roughly 2 liters. So you can see that they last, as we like to say, a good long time. And I looked up on the website. And by the way, don't believe any of these. When you get those 180s and 160s, you're in essence renting them for like $30 a month from the welding company that has them. If you buy, and the good thing is that when you get liquid nitrogen in that large quantity, it's relatively inexpensive. Anytime you own the Dewar and then have them refill it, usually they're going to charge you more. I know that's the case if they come out and do it. Now, maybe if you're out and you have a house, you can drive, obviously putting it in the trunk, not having it in the car with you. If you can drive there, you might be able to get a reasonable per liter price on a smaller Dewar, like a 50, a 35, or something like this. And if you can get roughly similar prices, because we're only paying like $1 a liter when you're getting like 180 or 200 liters, something like this. So if you can get a roughly equivalent price, so it's only costing you like $50 to fill a 50-liter Dewar, they can also be relatively economic from a holding standpoint. So they say, for instance, one of the companies I looked up has what's called a static hold time of 125 liters, which is 0.4 liters a day. I think that's in general a lie. I think they radically underestimate how much you're going to lose out, especially losing out on pouring when you're pouring and all this other stuff. And the other thing to remember about a Dewar is that as soon as they age, they start losing more, and when they get damaged at all, they start – and if you lose the vacuum, then you're done because it'll like lose its stuff in less than a day. So the good thing about not owning the Dewar, having the welding company own the Dewar, is that then if it starts having a problem, it's their problem and not your problem. You also asked why are all diners horrible. I don't have time to answer that now, so we'll try to get to that. Try to remember that next week. They're not – well, whatever. We'll talk about it. And then lastly, a while back you spoke about Columbo. Do you think he is actually married? He always talks about his wife, but she is never there. I think he is just making her up. I grew up beyond the Iron Curtain. I imagine because it's quite critical of American class society, we were allowed to watch it. It was by far my father's favorite show, usually followed with my parents arguing whether Columbo is actually married or not. Look at this guy. There is no way he is married. By the way, and then he wanted to know if he could come to the ham tasting. I didn't get this until now. I would have tried to sneak you in because I totally could have snuck you in maybe. But right, Jack? I could have snuck him in. Anyways, so I like the fact that like this like this paranoid Iron Curtain, plus it's the only thing you could watch behind the Iron Curtain, and somehow see Columbo. What's hilarious is that he is critical of class society, but to me he's like quintessential America because he wins, you know what I mean, in the end. But as to whether or not he is married, please look up www.columbo-slight.freeuk.com for a whole thing on Mrs. Columbo. Indeed, I think she does exist, and although I love the idea that there's a conspiracy that she doesn't exist and she's just some sort of prop that he uses to kind of beat the criminals, there are a couple episodes, in particular the one where he's on a cruise ship where Mrs. Columbo is seen by other characters in the thing, so they would have to be part of the larger conspiracy. Now, I know there are many places around the world that think Americans are capable of such kind of intense conspiracies, but I think it's only because they overestimate the general competence of people trying to do conspiracy. That's the problem. When people have conspiracy theories, right, the assumption is that somehow there are this large number of people out there who are A, competent to make a conspiracy happen, and B, can then keep it secret, which is almost never the case. Because people are both talkative and incompetent in general. True? Mm-hmm. Anyway. Yeah. You're like, oh, yeah.
It's about that time.
Oh, man. All right. So I have a lot of stuff that I missed. I'm going to list the stuff that I'm missing and that I will get to for the next time. All right?
We're going to keep track of it, too.
And we're going to keep track of it.
Thanks, Wyatt.
But we're not taking – we're not – anyway. So we had a question on – re-giving my thing for how to do sausages in an immersion blender from the Hashi food truck. We'll get to it. I don't think we got to Sam's autolyse step, or maybe we did last week, 2 weeks ago. I don't know. We got to figure it out. But most importantly, Christoph had a question on cooking bass, not striped bass, but black bass. So we'll get to that next week. Alex wrote in, and everyone wanted to hear about this, so it's a shame. Serious Eats, our friend at Serious Eats, Daniel Gritzer. Is he still at Food and Wine too, right?
He's at Food and Wine.
Food and Wine, but he wrote for Serious Eats this article about quality and tomatoes and refrigeration, which, you know, I got about 30 tweets saying, yeah, what's up about this? And I have responses, but don't have the time to get into it now. Maybe we can even have Daniel on. You want to try to see if we can get him on?
Fine.
We'll get him on. Anyway, Daniel's a good man, and I agree with some of his points and disagree with others of them, so we can, we'll get him on and we'll talk about it. And Sam Geiger asked me about my ideal salad niçoise, and we'll get to that next week. If I didn't mention it, it means that somehow we don't know that we didn't answer your question, so send it back in. Cooking issues!
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.